Welcome to Hadar's Web, a podcast featuring community conversations on spirituality, healing, justice, and art. My name is Hadar Cohen. I am your host, and I am delighted to invite you to my relational web.
Today's guest is Asaf Eliashalev. Asaf Eliashalev is an Israeli-American journalist with Mizrahi roots. Based in Los Angeles, he works as an investigative reporter for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. He was a historian behind the 2022 re-release of the Israeli Black Panther's Haggadah. He recently published a narrative nonfiction book titled Israel's Black Panthers, The Radicals Who Punctured a Nation's Founding Myth. Welcome, Asaf. So happy to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, there's so many questions I want to ask you about your latest book that just came out, which I just finished reading. But first, I wanted to ask you to share a little bit about the process of writing this book and how you actually got to writing this book.
Well, I wrote it while also doing a million other things, such as making a living in different jobs. I moved countries several times. I moved to different cities. I got married. I had two kids. So it was a prolonged process. And it started from a chance encounter I had with Reuven Aberzel, one of the founders of the Panthers, many, many years ago. And we sat down for interviews, and I had no idea that I'd be writing a book. I maybe I had some idea, but it was just a general thing that I felt like I needed to do. And he was very into the idea. And over time, as I developed as a journalist and realized that no one had told the story of the Black Panthers in full, and not in this way, at least. There had been kind of portrayals in theater but not in this way. I decided to do more than go beyond the interviews with Reuven, and to interview everyone I could possibly find, and hit the archives and collect news coverage from the time. Do you want me to talk about, do you want to say more about that, or?
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely the research is very extensive, and I want to hear more about that. But I guess I also want to hear how you first met Reuven and like what your connection, right? Because it's also feel, I mean, even as you are writing this as a historian and a researcher, as all these things, it's also in some ways a personal story.
Yeah. So I grew up in the United States, but also I spent a big chunk of my childhood in Israel. I come from an Iraqi and Bulgarian family, one side and the other. And I went to college at UC Berkeley. And there I, got a little bit into activism, and I was also learning about the American Black Panthers. I wrote my biggest paper in college about the American Black Panthers. I chanced upon a reference on the internet to the Israeli Black Panthers, and it said something about, on Wikipedia, it said something about they represented the struggle of Mizrahi Jews. And I said, wait, isn't that my family? What is this all about? This is a little weird. I want to know more. But there was almost like no information online about the American Black Panthers at the time, certainly not in English, or no information about the Israeli Black Panthers, certainly not in English. At the same time, I was like, I had a lot of friends who were Arab on campus from Syria and Iraq and the West Bank and all kinds of places. And, when it came up that I was like, had Iraqi heritage, they would do this thing where like, they'd take your glasses off. Oh, you're Asaf, you're one of us. And I looked more Arab, I guess, with my glasses off. That helped me realize that there's something significant here to my heritage, that I'm not just like another Ashkenazi American Jew. And I wanted to lean into figuring out what that means and like learning more about my family's experience in Israel. I also remembered like as a kid, in Israel, one of the first questions you ask when you meet someone is like, what is your motza? What is your like ethnic background? And at least growing up, that's what it was like. I don't know if it's like that today still. I imagine so. And I remember as a kid, I'd always say Bulgarian first, or just Bulgarian. Like, why? Why was I doing it? Like, what lesson did I internalize it? Like, it was preferable to be Bulgarian than Iraqi. Like, something was going on for me to have done that as a kid.
Which is interesting because I had the same experience. Not that I
Yeah.
have any like Ashkenazi or European, but I actually pretended I was Ashkenazi because I didn't want people to know
Yeah.
I was me. Like I thought I could hide it, you know?
Yeah. And so I, as a 23 or 24-year-old, I moved to Israel. So after college, Great Recession is happening. So I got a job as a news editor at Haaretz. I was very lucky to get a job like that in the economy that that we had at the time. And and I happened to meet Reuven at a party, but before I'd met him before, like a year earlier. I went to Israel on this trip. I took a tour of Musrara that was led by Reuven, and he was telling his the story of the Panthers, and I was just like shocked that someone could even talk this way. Like, he was saying stuff I hadn't seen anywhere else. He was speaking with like a fire and a passion and a sense of urgency, the 70-year-old man at the time. I couldn't get it out of my mind. I'd recently read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and I was like, oh, this guy sounds like the Israeli Malcolm X. So it left a big impression. That was, and I come to Israel, work to work for Haaretz. A month into my moving to Israel, a friend invites me to like a party. It turns out it was at a bar frequented by the people that were doing the tent protests, the Rothschild like tent protests in Israel at the time. So like a lot of activists were there, and Reuven was there, and we talked, and I told him I'm this like American Israeli, I speak Hebrew, I speak English, I write in English, I'm Mizrahi, I want to know more about the Panthers. And he's like, let's sit down and talk. Like, I want the story to come out in English. And at some point in our conversations, he kind of described his feeling, his whole life as being stuck in prison. Like, talking to me felt like smuggling a letter out of prison. He felt like his lack of English kept his story from getting out. And so it's important for him to share through me with the world. And we ended up doing these, just like he had given a tour that I went on now. He was doing tours, and I was interpreting for an English-speaking crowd. So every week for like 2 years, I went to Musa and walked with him on the little pathways in Musa, and had groups that we would tell the story to. And I learned how to speak. He was speaking through me, like I'm having to take what he's saying. And he speaks philosophically, and he speaks at different. Not only that, he speaks at a very high register of Hebrew, but he also switches a lot because he's for someone who didn't go to school beyond third grade, like his abilities are just insane. His verbal and intellectual abilities are just off the charts. And I had to live, like, put it into English. And so I got a little bit better every time. And I really internalized his voice. And so that became very, very helpful later on when I had to write him as a character in my book. Right, it's a complete fact-based. But I'm writing it as a work of narrative nonfiction. So Reuven is a character, and there's scenes, and there's a plot. And so that's kind of how we got to the book.
So that it seems like that relationship with Reuven really, I mean, this research for the book you said took over like 10 years to really have the conversation, interview the people, go into the archives, and translate it into the larger international world. And one thing I wanted to also just acknowledge that at the end of the book you mention how five of the people that you interviewed for this book have now passed away. And I think actually now it's six
And the
with.
time between when the book was completed and it was published, Charlie Beaton died. Yeah.
So I guess I wanted to ask you about, you said Reuven spoke with a sense of urgency, which is a certain urgency that is familiar to me and I feel as well too. But given that, a significant number of the people you interviewed have passed. Like, how do you hold this creation now, in terms of like telling the story? And maybe also in relationship with that, like, why do you think there hasn't been more written about the Black Panthers, the Israeli Black Panthers in English?
Can you explain the first part of the question again?
Well, just, I mean, I guess I will share for me personally, you know, I think we're at this time where it's definitely in the Mizrahi community, like a lot of our elders are dying. You know, a lot of the people who either knew a time pre-48 or, you know, were part of the activism on the ground, like the Black Panthers in Jerusalem, and their stories, right? There's kind of a lack of honoring of their stories and lack of documentation. And I think, you know, that's part of been for me. I've been wanting to like fill that role of being like, well, how do we actually remember our lineage and not just let it be distorted by powers that be? And, you know, to me, I feel like there's a similarity there. So I guess I wanted to hear how, like, how you relate to that, you know, the people that you are interviewing and this, you know, very monumental work in some ways that they're also dying at this time, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it was their story is so remarkable, and all these people I interviewed are so remarkable. They came from nothing and they burst into the world with like this creative energy, and helped shape like Mizrahi culture and the larger Israeli culture in all kinds of profound ways. And I think it's a shame that like not more people get to experience these people. And so it's like just an honor to be able to chronicle their story. It's incredible. It was incredibly hard to do. Getting basic facts about the Panthers was it took a lot of digging and cross-checking many different sources. And there's some things where I still didn't know for sure what had happened. So I think, you know, it's I don't know exactly how this book is going to be used and by whom, I felt it was like my duty ultimately to like to do right by the story and to tell to like document for posterity what exactly had happened. And I did think throughout the process, as I go into like an archive and I pull some file on the Panthers, like why had no one else asked for this file before? Because that happened multiple times. There has been some research. There's some journalists who've published, you know, exposés and different things about the Panthers over the years. There's a few academics who've done work. There was an ethnographer who was getting her PhD in sociology, and she followed the Panthers and wrote a dissertation that is actually hard, kind of hard to access. So there's that. Sami Shalom Shitri did pioneering work on the Israeli Mizrahi struggle with a chapter on the Panthers. But no one had really told the story in full. And part of that is Israeli academia in general has a blind spot about Mizrahim. Something in journalism. I remember working at Haaretz at the time and a very liberal paper in Israel. And there were probably more voices of Palestinians in the paper than there were of Mizrahim. And nothing against like having Palestinian voices, but it's funny, it was most Ashkenazi and then a lot of Palestinians and like very few Mizrahim, even though they're the bigger group in Israel. And I think something I noticed that it was happening in academia, a lot of people were interested in theorizing about the role the Panthers played. So they're having these like intellectual debates and academic debates where were they a class struggle or were they a racial struggle or you know, were they, you know, truly communist or like all these like terms and how they fit with them? And okay, you know, I read all the articles and I learned a lot, but why did no one interview like this person that interviewed? Why did no one pull back the file? Like, I think sometimes people doing scholarly work feel like they can substitute like the archival and interview work with just intellectual exercises. And I think that's like a mistake of, that's a mistake of, that for the larger field of academia.
Yeah. So, okay, let's get into it. Who were the Black Panthers? And, you know, I think it's also, I'm excited to just have this conversation because I'm from Jerusalem and I actually spent a number of years in Oakland. And I think the American Black Panthers definitely inspired my understanding of racial justice. But I don't know if I even told you this, but my parents, you know, they both grew up in Jerusalem around the time, and they were in high school around the time of the Black Panthers. And they always very much connected. I mean, my dad would always say he was like more of a nerd and a shy guy, so he wasn't fully involved, but he was always like, we were always supporting from afar. So I also actually kind of did grow up a bit with some of the Panther narrative from home. But yeah, I'm really also curious, right, to also have this conversation about like between Jerusalem and Oakland and racial justice. So why don't you just start by telling us who were.
Well, I want to start with a really interesting parallel between the American and the Black, the American Panthers and the Israeli ones, one that's not obvious, that took a while for me to realize and discover. But the founders of the American group, the original group, is Huey Newton. And the founder of the Israeli group, you know, in the moments before Reuven entered the scene and also became a founder, like the very first person, was Saadia Marziano. Both of them were young men who had gotten into a lot of trouble throughout their life and found themselves as at around age 20, not even knowing how to read and write. Both of them got radicalized through literacy, by learning how to read and write. And I thought that's an amazing thing, the power of knowledge. Another thing that's very common to their biography is Huey Newton, his family came to Oakland as part of the great migration of Black Americans from the South to the North, to the cities of the North and the West, right? That's a huge demographic pattern that shapes a lot of what the United States is today. Saadia Marziano is also the product of a historic migration, a migration of Jews from Arab countries in mass to Israel. I mean, they went to other countries too, but the biggest number of them went to Israel. And so they both are these individuals who are like thrust by history into the lowest level, lowest rungs of society, and find their way out of that through this embrace of knowledge and this like burning anger about what had happened to their community and a strong desire to do something about it. So the emergence of the Panthers owes a lot to like this personality, this unique and powerful personality that is Saadia Marziano, who is the leader of this group of friends in Jerusalem. So you have Jerusalem at the time, and throughout Israel, you have thousands of young men with no prospects in life. They're not in the military and they're not working. And they organize into street gangs. Right. And this is a male phenomenon, right? The girls are more likely to be at home. They are more beholden to their parents' expectations. The young men, for wider social reasons, are kind of more likely to have gone to juvenile delinquency, to institutions for juvenile delinquents, to find themselves on the street, to cast out of like the family home. And so Israel has this like street gang problem on its hands.
Which is largely Mizrahi.
Yeah, 100% Mizrahi, right? But the Panthers didn't start in Tel Aviv or Haifa or, you know, or Rishon LeZion or Rent Simon. They start in Jerusalem, and not just any place in Jerusalem, in the neighborhood of Musara. So we have this like sociological phenomenon of the street gangs. We have the unparalleled kind of personal force of Saadia Marziano. And we also have the circumstances that are very particular to that neighborhood. Everyone in Musara, all the people who grew up there at the time, lived through the 50s and 60s, where it was a war zone. Musara was in the very heart of Jerusalem, where it was divided between Jordanian East Jerusalem and Israeli West Jerusalem. They had barbed wire fences running through the neighborhood. They had these barricades against like the advance of tanks if there was ever an invasion. And there were Jordanian and Israeli snipers positioned on opposite side from each other, and they're like living below, and sometimes like they get shot at. And there was like this tense state of war for years and years and years. And they actually, a lot of the Panthers were living in a no man's land. It officially belonged to no one, and Israeli services didn't go into those areas. So for many of them, the only interaction they had with the Israeli state was like the police that would like come to chase after them into the neighborhood if like they thought if they were caught stealing something or something like that. But maybe no schooling, you know. At some point, social workers start arriving, very interesting Mizrahi social workers who have a huge role to play. But Musala, right, is this like Jerusalem's the backwaters at the time, and Musala is like the backwaters of the backwaters. And then 1967 happens, and then everything changes. Just like the Berlin Wall falls, and that is known as a massive moment in history. In Jerusalem, you have a different wall falling, a wall separating east and west. And Musala goes from being on the edge of the Israeli state and of Jerusalem to the very center. It becomes an extremely desirable neighborhood for real estate developers, for example. It is adjacent to the old city. Everyone from in Israel, but all over the West, wants to go to the old city now. Israelis are exploring the ancient sites. Foreigners are arriving en masse. They are bringing rock and roll with them. They're bringing radical politics from certainly they're bringing imagery and stories of the American Black Panthers, but also the Tupamaros from Uruguay and movements that are happening in Europe. So they're bringing that, and they're bringing that to the cafe culture of Jerusalem in the late 60s and 70s. Ashkenazi students from West Jerusalem actually physically walk through Musala to get to their university on the other side on Mount Scopus in East Jerusalem. Or if they want to go to the old city, they pass through Musala to buy hashish. And if they're too scared to talk to Palestinians and to buy hashish, they ask the Mizrahim to go buy it for them. Because the Mizrahim had figured out a way, even when the fence was up, they'd figure out a way to make connections with Palestinians on the other side, you know, through yelling across the fence or you know, tossing a ball or just years of like observing each other. And slowly as the wall comes down, realizing like how many similarities they have amongst each other, language, food, culture.
Yeah, I think actually that was my favorite chapter, is around the interactions between Mizrahim and Palestinians in Jerusalem.
If anyone wants to pay me to do a book just on that, that would be, that I think is like the most interesting thing.
It is the most interesting thing. Because it spoke to, I mean, a lot of very profound insights. But one is that, you know, there's sometimes this phrase around Mizrahim of being like imported Arabs, right? There's a local Arabs who are Palestinians, and then there's like imported Arabs who are Mizrahim. But just like this interaction of being like, wait, you actually look similar to me, but what's going on here? And like trying to kind of understand these dynamics, but also feeling a sense of comfort, you know, which I think is what I got from that chapter.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. First of all, there are, of course, Mizrahim that were from the area of Palestine. Okay. But just like Reuven Abergel tells, he grew up among Muslims in Morocco. Well, you know where Yasser Arafat grew up? Yasser Arafat grew up in the Moroccan quarter of Jerusalem, living among Jews. So that's an interesting like juxtaposition. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
Actually, I have some of my family, my grandfather's brothers were actually friends with Arafat because of the fact that they grew up in the old city.
Yeah. And so, you know, there was a moment in 2003, I believe, where Reuven actually travels to meet Arafat. When Israel was engaged in fighting with Ramallah, and there was a siege, and so Is, you know, everything around the Mukataa, around Yasser Arafat's headquarters, is like kind of being bombed, and that was like, you know, the one zone, and Israelis would go like to act as human shields. Anyway, Reuven Aberge went there and met with him and like talked to them. They talked about their childhood and they shared these stories with each other.
That's really, yeah, really fascinating. Okay, before we dive more deeply into the Panther story, maybe we can just share a little bit of the context of Mizrahi life in this newly established state of Israel, right? Because a lot of the times, and I think this book touches on it a few times, right? The sense that Zionism kind of created this Jewish unity, right? Oh, okay, like all Jews are brothers in this fight together. But really, in practice and in actuality, that Jewish unity didn't translate really, right? And we see the racial dynamics between Ashkenazim and Mizrahim. But right, there's a context to which the Panthers are kind of coming through. And I think particularly, you know, you had also a whole chapter dedicated to Wadi Salib and, you know, the protests that were happening there. So yeah, I would love to if you just provide a bit more context about that.
Yeah, and there's a reason the subtitle of the book is The Radicals Who Punctured a Nation's Founding Myth. It's exactly what you're talking about. So when Israel, before Israel was founded, if you go all the way back to Herzl, political Zionism arose to solve a problem being faced by the Jews of Europe, that they were horribly mistreated. And the idea was, we are going to solve that problem by going to Palestine and creating a Jewish state there. And that state was explicitly supposed to be modeled on a European country. Like, they wanted to establish a European-looking country for European Jews in Palestine. That's what they said. That's what they all talked about. That's not a controversial... it shouldn't be a controversial thing. It's an historical fact. Today, there's a lot of discourse around that issue of like, oh, don't call it a white country, don't call it a European country. But like, that's what the people who founded it were talking about doing. They had a problem, though. In the early 20th century, the Jews in the Soviet Union decided, you know, Russia and then the Soviet Union, that whole part of Europe, they, for the most part, didn't listen to the Zionists and go to Palestine. They went to the United States, right? Millions of Jews ended up in the United States. And then later on, the Holocaust involved, right, the absolute destruction of European Jewry. 6 million Jews who maybe could have gone to Palestine were dead now. And after World War II, the last kind of reservoir of Jews on the continent were behind the Iron Curtain. And Soviet Union wasn't allowing Jews to leave. So you have, what, 600,000 Jews in the Yishuv pre-state. It's not enough to establish a country in the circumstances that they had. And so this idea starts catching more steam of bringing the Jews from the Arab countries. There are about a million of them, and they need soldiers. They need people to work in factories, to till the fields, to build roads.
Arabic also.
Yeah, it's good they speak for the intelligence services. And they need more legitimacy, right? Like, they need more numbers in order to say, in order to have like a demographic balance with the Palestinians. And so it's, the story is very different actually from country to country in the Middle East of how and why the Jews came to Israel or left. And like I said, not all of them went to Israel, a lot went to France or to Canada and different places. But so I don't want to talk, you know, that's a whole other conversation about why and how the Jews left these countries and came to Israel. But a lot of them did do that. And they came with a certain promise, a certain idea that was told to them, that they're coming to be brothers in the creation of a modern Jewish kingdom or a modern Jewish state. It happened to be led by David Ben-Gurion, and who's of course named after King David. And Mizrahim, at that time, certainly, and today, cared very much about Jewish tradition and the symbolism of a new Jewish state being led by David Ben Gurion that mattered to people. And they wanted what was being promised, a place to thrive as Jews, to be in brotherhood with Jews from all over the world. And they come to Israel and something a little different is what they got. They were treated very condescendingly by the establishment, by the Ashkenazim that were there. But condescension is a very important part of what happened.
And still happens.
But too often in Israeli conversations, that's where it stops. Yeah. The Ashkenazim were condescending. Everyone can agree that they were condescending, right? That they talk to them in ways that are like not so nice. Right? Even the name Black Panthers, why is that such an appropriate name for this group, right? It sounds, oh, they're not even black. They're you know, I'm not black, you're not black. Even though we're both Mizrachim. Well, Ashkenazim would call Mizrachim Shvarzechaya in Yiddish. It means black animal. So the Panthers were, in a sense, Israeli Panthers were reclaiming that term. Oh, we're Shvarzechaya? No, we're Black Panthers. Thank you very much.
I was also called like Shachoret. Like,
yeah, you know? Yeah. So like yeah. In the Israeli context, it was black, but like it sounds weird when you put it in an American context, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, to get back to where we were, so it's not just condescension, right? That's very important. There are explicit policies and practices in place that create massive discrimination against Mizrachim. Not just discrimination, the creation of a second-class citizenship for Mizrachim. And that is done through every aspect of life, housing, employment, education, anything you can think of. In terms of, they come in, the immigrants from Europe or from the Middle East, and they're put into these transit camps. Oh yeah, I won't touch the thing so they won't. Into the transit camps. And then the Europeans are far more quickly transferred out into like real housing in the center of the country. Mizrachim languish in these camps for a lot longer, which are just like tent encampments, like in the dirt. And then when they are allowed to leave and like settled somewhere, they're often settled in the very far reaches of the country, in the margins and in the desert, places like Dimona, which were just tents on a plot of land with nothing. And they're deposited there and like, you cannot leave. And there's active measures to prevent people from leaving these like remote locales where they put them. And they're not only remote and far away from economic opportunity, they're also on the border, on the borders with the Arab enemies, the Arab enemy countries. And so they are exposed to violence from Palestinian raiders that are coming in and attacking Israeli towns. Like who has to suffer that the most? Mizrachim. Anytime Egypt or Jordan or Syria threaten to invade, well, who's going to be the first that's going to be harmed by that?
Which later on we see is part in, which, you know, I think it's so interesting that you ended the book there with the relationship between Panthers and the Likud and kind of right wing.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, right, exactly what you're speaking to is that Mizrachim often also bear the brunt of the violence that comes to them, right, from Palestinian or Arab. So then that kind of over time develops a certain level of like right-wing ideology.
Another great example of that is what happens in the second Intifada with the bus bombings. Well, who takes the bus?
Yeah.
Like, who? Poor people take the bus, larger, right? Of course, Ashkenazim take the bus too, but like, who is overrepresented on the bus?
Yeah.
And in education, for example, they had this idea that Mizrachim are backwards, that they spent too much time with the Muslims and the Arabs, and that they're like, their intellectual level would decrease because of it, right? Yeah, so they're like, well, they won't be able to keep up with like the academic, knowledge. And so we need to wait a few generations so they can catch up. And so we will give them this more simple education. It was very convenient, right? It's being done in a way like to help these poor people who aren't very smart. So we have to help along. But in effect, what it says is Ashkenazim, where they live, are routed to academic programs when they graduate from high school. Mizrachim are routed to vocational school.
Right.
So, you know, you could actually read all about this. Carl Frankenstein had a whole theory about the rate and the pace of Mizrahi cognitive development. And the education system was designed around his theories. Sami Shalom Shitrit wrote about this extensively, and the Adva Center was able to bear this all out in statistics over the years. They actually showed that the socioeconomic status of Ashkenazim went up when the Mizrahim arrived. They went from being like the Poalim, the laborers, to being the managers.
Right.
And the Mizrahim went from a higher status. They were had higher income, had more education, and then more status, and then they come to Israel and it goes down.
Right. So they had more of that.
More in Casablanca and Baghdad and in Istanbul and all these countries that were, you know, it was really ironic the way in which the founders of Israel talked about Mizrahim as being cave dwellers, that saying that they came from living in caves or living in the mountains. Like Baghdad and Istanbul and Casablanca and Marrakesh were like, and Alexandria and Cairo were far more metropolitan than Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
So it's just a funny, they just got it wrong. They were just completely misinformed in a way that was devastating about the Mizrahim that they had imported to come live with them. And that is, it's not only materially damaging to Mizrahim when they arrive, it's also psychologically very harmful, because it feels like a betrayal. Like, why would you treat me this way? I thought we were Jewish brothers and sisters. Like, what happened to all that talk? Like, I was down.
Yeah.
We were down to do it with you. Like, we were down to build this together. Like, why would you treat us that way? It doesn't make any sense. Like, Jews don't behave this way to other Jews. And for some, that made some Mizrahim became very angry as a result of that. But I think the Panthers, a lot of them told me their parents, their reaction to it was like to become like these downtrodden people, like with their head down. And they weren't able to look up to their parents as young people because they saw them as being weak, as having just resigned to like to a lower status. I get emotional around this because this idea that like the loss of respect for your parents is like a very devastating feeling.
Yeah, it's yeah, and I can resonate with that, because when you see. That was actually so much of my political education, of just recognizing the way that my parents were traumatized by the state. And like, instead of just seeing them as my parents, also seeing them as individuals who have their story and what was done to them. And then things just started making sense, you know? And it is really hard. It's really hard to contend with. Certainly, I mean, what was kind of done to us as Mizrahim, but also it's like, how do we, you know, and actually, I think you talked about this a bit of like, right. And actually, I think this is where there's some interesting parallels with the wider Arab community, because this whole sense of like honor and respect is actually so deeply ingrained in us as people, like to be respected, to be valued. And like, when there is kind of that attack on our dignity, it goes really deep, you know, and then the assertion of wanting to fight back. To reclaim that,
and it's fucked up that Mizrahim are ridiculed for caring about respect and honor, right?
Right, like, totally.
You know, like,
100%.
Well, easy for someone to say who hasn't ever been like treated in that way.
Totally. Yeah, like, why? Who are you people? Why do you care so much about respect?
Yeah.
Well, okay. So I want to talk about some of the like. Yeah, can you talk a little bit about Wadi Salib and like what was happening there? Because that I think is a really important moment in history where there was actually like, no, we're going to fight back around this.
Yeah. And the way it started off is remarkably similar to how a lot of protests around racial justice have started in the United States. It takes place in the city of Haifa, in northern Israel, Israel's third largest city. in a neighborhood that's actually a lot like Musrara in the sense that it's poor and working class and Mizrahi. It's the neighborhood of Wadi Salib. And also like Musrara, it's a neighborhood that was previously populated by Palestinians until they were forced out or fled in 1948. Police come in, they get reports about like a guy who was allegedly drunk or something or disorderly in public, and they shoot him. They end up shooting him. The neighborhood learns that this happened. People think he died, so he didn't die. He actually was rushed to the hospital and his life was saved, but like the neighborhood thinks he was killed by police. Then this dam breaks loose of like the police needs to stop beating us up. They need to stop mistreating us. And not just the police, the whole establishment, they go and they, what do? They target the police station, throwing stuff at the police station, but they also target the Mapai Party's like local headquarters, because they attribute their condition to the Mapai Labor Party of Israel. They march and they fight with police on the streets. They organize committees. They put out like manifestos. And this goes on for weeks and months. There isn't much coverage of it at the time. Israel has no television in 1959. Radio is limited, is in control of the government, and there's not many options. And even the newspapers hardly cover this, except for the communist newspaper and Ha'olam Hazeh, which give it extensive coverage. But without mass media, you would think that maybe it would be contained to Haifa and to Wadi Salib. But no, Mizrahi networks are able to spread word of this, and there's protests all over the country. And that's when Israel has its first reckoning about the Mizrahi Ashkenazi divide. And they have a public commission, an investigative government commission, to look at the issue that was raised. And actually, they didn't even do that with the Panthers, right? That's the only time. There's been commissions around the Yemenite affair and different things, but no government body has ever, like, since then, before, since, made it its mission to figure out what is happening with racism in Israel. They reach like conclusions that are just demonstrably false, like that it's that it shows that there's a lot of poverty among Mizrahim, that it shows they're able to determine that there's inequality. Not very hard, but they claim that it's not due to any deliberate policy, that this is just because of historical circumstances about how Mizrahim arrived with less resources or some nonsense like that. It's not anyone's fault. It's not anyone's fault. It's sad and hopefully it gets better, but it's not anyone's fault. That's what they conclude. And then there's really interesting connections that I discovered between Wadi Salim and the agitation happening then and the Panthers later. If you want me to talk about that, but like,
But also just in Wadi Salib, like that was one of the protests where they also like right, they took the Israeli flags and dipped it in blood. Was that
So they're on this march.
I just that's such a powerful
It's
image.
a powerful image. There's probably more to be done. I mean, it's actually, Wadi Salib in some ways is like very well documented, in a way that the Panthers, there's a lot of contentions about that, what actually happened. But yes, they go on this march and the flag is either an Israeli flag or like a blank flag or something, like a sheet. I've seen both versions. Yeah, and it's dipped in blood and they wave it.
And it's also like, I mean, from the telling that I remember, is that they also were like, take us back to Morocco. You know, we want to return back to
Oh, I
Morocco.
mean, that from day one of Moroccans arriving, like they had 1 year where more Moroccans are leaving, were leaving than coming into the country. That's a whole thing.
But this whole, right, like, yeah, I mean, I like that you were talking about this as like this myth, right? This dream that a lot of Mizrahim were fed, which led to their migration of like, oh, you're going to be in the promised land with other Jews. It's going to be this utopia. And then the rupture of that, and to say like, actually, it was better for us in Morocco or in Baghdad.
How could that be? Yeah.
But then also, yeah, I mean, obviously, depending on where Mizrahim are from, like, for many, like not having the option to return back, right? Mm-hmm. So
that's something that has always infuriated Rouven Aubergel. He's like, they massacred you in Europe, and 2 days later you can go back there.
Yeah,
it's like Germany was completely open to people, like very quickly after World War II and the Holocaust. Like, why can't I go back to like all my countries? I mean, Morocco is like this exception, right? But like, why can't I go back to Syria or to Iraq or to Egypt or, you know, any of these?
Right.
And actually Morocco now, more, you know,
yeah,
complicated history of Morocco-Israel relations, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the Panthers are kind of, you know, they're not the first ones to really challenge, right? I mean, it seems like Mizrahim all over are finding different ways to really see, understand what was happening to them and to resist that in some ways. But the Panthers, right, as you said, are particular to Jerusalem, to Musara. So tell us a little bit about the stories of the founders of the Panthers.
Yeah.
And I know you interviewed many of them, but so.
Yeah, I mean, you want like the stories of, well, of what they did as Panthers?
Yeah, because I mean, the book details a lot of that, like, right, the meetings that they had, how they found the name, like, I mean, whatever you want to share. I know this, it's a lot of details, but just like to give a bit more into what did it mean to like, right, claim being a Black Panther in Jerusalem, and what was associated with that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I open the book with the famous story of Operation Milk. And, you know, a year into the Panthers, they come up with this idea. At the time, if you're rich in Israel, not even rich, if you're like well off, you know, you would get milk freshly delivered to your door in the morning. Like the milkman would come, leave bottles there, these glass bottles that you'd have to return at the end of the day or the next day. And if you're poor, like you just didn't get that. You couldn't afford to. So they went out to Rehavia one day at like 4 a.m. Rehavia is like one of the wealthier neighborhoods in Jerusalem. And they like steal all the bottles that are on the doorsteps. And they leave little notes saying, thank you so much for your contribution to the war on poverty and for your support for the Panthers. And we're so sorry that your poor kittens won't get milk today. And then they drive across town to a neighborhood with like the funniest name, Asbestonim. Like the neighborhood is named after these asbestos sheets that they used to build the houses. Like that's how shitty the houses are. That the whole neighborhood is like named after these like shitty asbestos sheets, which of course are like toxic and you should not be using them like for human habitation in this way. And they put the bottles there and they're like, here you go. You know, the Panthers are glad we're able to give you these bottles this morning, and please enjoy them, but don't expect this tomorrow. If you want milk, you join our struggle. Yeah, so that was like this thing. Of course, the press covered it extensively, and it became like an Israeli legend. If anyone knows anything about the Panthers, they probably know that story. You know, other examples is in writing the Haggadah, right? So the Panthers are very secular. They came from very traditional, observant Jewish homes, so they knew all the traditions and the rituals and the prayers. But they were, as I mentioned, this is the era of hippies and radicals and communists and Maoists and Marxists, and that is the kind of influence that they borrow from. Of course, the American Black Panthers are Marxists and atheists, and so they are mostly like they don't talk about God. what they do is they decide to write their own version of the Haggadah, and they cast themselves as Moses, as the people delivering Bnei Israel, and they cast Golda Meir, who was the prime minister at the time, as Pharaoh. And I think of this Haggadah that they wrote as a sequel to the original Haggadah, not even as its own version, as a sequel. Because in the original, right, the Jews or the Hebrews are in Egypt, and they're slaves, and they escape to freedom, and they go to the promised land, right? But what happens there?
Right.
What happens there? And in this modern retelling, it's not so good.
Yeah.
It's not so good. And it flips the script on, like, where is exile and where is the promised land, and that way it's very, very smart and very interesting. And they do, you know, they also just are in the streets protesting a lot, which ends up in like these street fights with police, where the police like shoot water cannons at them, and the Panthers are like throwing stuff back at them. Don't get me wrong, like. Yeah.
And you know, they were also imprisoned.
They're imprisoned and you know, always charged with crimes, in and out of prison.
Well, so I want to actually talk about Golda Meir, because she comes up a lot, right, as being the prime minister. But something I thought was really sharp as how you framed it, right, because Golda Meir was actually very aware, especially of American social justice issues, and was seemingly seen as very progressive. And even till now, you know, there was the most recent film that came out about Golda Meir as this like heroic, liberal, like, you know, ideology that she was holding. But, you know, from the Panthers perspective and from Mizrahi perspective, like, I really like seeing, like, kind of framing her as a pharaoh, right? Because that's who she was to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm wondering if you could touch base a little bit about Golda Meir and her character as, like, on the one hand, like, being seen as this, right, the first woman prime minister, being all about equality, but then somehow that doesn't actually apply to Mizrahim.
Yeah,
or Arabs, really.
Yeah, ironically, I'm kind, part of me is on, like, Team Golda.
Oh no.
Let me explain.
Okay.
She is known as, I think now she's, her reputation is getting rehabilitated a little bit with this movie, but like, she's considered a total failure. And that's how I always learned the story of Golda Meir. Not because of the stuff of the Panthers, like, because of like the 1973 war, right? She was prime minister when Israel was invaded and like nearly, you know, defeated by the Arab armies. And that's pretty bad, like, if you're prime minister. When I read the history, like, I don't think it's her fault. Mm-hmm. So she did everything except for the military stuff, like, in her background, right? She had these famous men who are generals, Moshe Dayan and these guys, who were like, no, we got this. We know what we're doing. And she asked them, oh, do we need to worry about the war? And they're like, no. Moshe Dayan, all these are telling her no. What is she supposed to, like, tell them they're wrong? Like, no, that's not her expertise. So they fucked up. She gets blamed. She gets blamed. She's the prime minister. The buck stops with her. But like, that failure, like, erased everything she had done. And now let's set aside for a second the Mizrahi thing and the Palestinian issue, which these are big issues. These are big issues. But just look at her as, like, her resume. She was an absolute force. Like, she built state institutions. She was involved in foreign policy. In 1948, Israel might have lost the war if it wasn't for Golda Meir. She went to the United States and, like, in one day, like, fundraised everything, like, a huge amount of money from American Jewry through, like, these speeches that she gave. And without that money, they would not have been able to buy the weapons to go, like, and win that. And she was very, very involved in social welfare policy and in work training and in housing and all these realms. So she did a million things and contributed more than, like, a lot of the men who are, like, then ends up being heroes because they won some battle or something, right? So in that sense, I'm pro-Golda, that this is not fair, that she is but in the Zionist mythology, she's not treated fairly. On the other hand, she was totally a pharaoh and a total racist, against Palestinians, of course, right? She refused to acknowledge that they exist, and said a million things that wouldn't be acceptable. I certainly today, whatever. I don't know what's acceptable and what's not, but I can certainly tell you the way she talked about Mizrahim was racist and was typical to her background, to her Ashkenazi establishment background. So she, right, she took socialism very seriously. She was born in Ukraine and what is today Ukraine, and grows up in the United States, becomes involved with the Zionist movement and in the socialist side of the Zionist movement, and comes to Israel and is very into, before it's Israel, and it's very into the labor movement. And easy to say she got a lot of things wrong when it comes to progressive politics, but she was a true believer in this idea of establishing Israel as a socialist country. And here come these hooligans and tell her, "So what's socialism? Look at us. What are you talking about with your socialism? You have more than half the people who live 10 people to a room, or live in very crowded conditions." And she doesn't like that at all. She does. She tries to swat them away.
Well, they were also, in that time protesting, creating commotion, trying to alter public discourse. And you're right, there was this interest in kind of repressing that because,
I mean, she does something very serious that I don't think many histories of Israel. I've never seen anyone take this thing that she did as serious as I think it deserves to be taken. But before the Panthers did a single action, when they're just planning a protest, right? Police realize they're spying on the Panthers from the very, very beginning. They're like, "Oh, they're planning a protest. Let's see what we do about it." They take it to their commander, who takes it to his commander. It gets to the national chief of police. It gets to the minister of police. Minister of police tells Golda Meir, she summons a meeting of her top advisors, Minister of Justice, Minister of Police, Mayor Teddy Kollek, the National Police Chief, some other people, and they're discussing, and we have minutes from this meeting. What do we do about this group? This is very bad. This is very scary. They're going to destabilize. What if they're violent? Do you remember Wadi Salib? That was really bad. We can't have this. What do we do? Do we give them permit to protest? Do we not give them permit to protest? And there's this idea that they should arrest them and prevent this protest from happening. And Golda Meir authorizes the police to do that. That's her call. That's her decision. That's how the meeting ends. Arrest them. Wait, have they committed a crime? What arresting people for wanting to hold a protest? That's a violation of your civil rights, a violation of your free speech. And nothing like that had ever happened to Jewish Israelis before. As far as I know, I've never been able to find anything like this before. As far as I know, this is the very first time that the Israeli, and this is what the Israeli police commander at the time, who I interviewed, told me. It's like, we went to the we applied a law that was on the books from British times, an emergency law that allows us to preemptively detain people before they've done anything wrong. Today, many Palestinians are arrested under the same law. An administrative detention is what they call it. But he says, we pulled that out of our hats. We looked and we found this weird law, and we used it for the first time, is what he said. And he said it to me in my interview, and he also said it back then. I found that he was before I talk about how arresting them preemptively, of course, backfires, it's also morally, legally, politically, like this is a very, very big precedent in Israeli history. And I'd like more scholars and journalists to take that aspect of things seriously. Yeah, and of course, like to just complete the story, when word got out that they like, what do they do? They go, the police now spend an entire day raiding little cafes and little houses all over Jerusalem to try to catch like these 15 people, and arrest them. And I found I found their names. Like no one else has. It's impossible to find who were the 15 people who were arrested. Everyone said they were arrested that day. Everyone's memories is like, oh, I was there, I was there, I was there. Like this was one of the hardest things about the book. I had people telling me I was at this meeting between this historic meeting between the Black Panthers and Golda Meir. I was there.
Or she called them not nice, but
And then
no.
she was talking about that meeting when she called them not nice, but there were five Panthers at the meeting. And there's a transcript of the meeting. We know exactly who was there, but like a lot of people remembered being there. And
Sketchily were
they
there.
weren't lying to me. Like they identified with the Panthers so fully that this was real to them. And I'm not taking that away from them. I'm not calling them liar. That's their truth. But like for my kind of book, this is like though not helpful. It's like the worst thing you could do. Like, stop saying these things to me. Like, I don't have to trust anything you're telling me anymore.
Well, but in that meeting where afterwards she does call the Panthers being not nice, right? This and this whole I mean, that to me has also been really inspiring, right? Because then there's an organization that got formed, like Lo Nechmadim, Lo Nechmadol, right? Not nice, about kind of reclaiming that as a Mizrahi person and being like, yeah, I'm not nice, And I think that that there's something, I mean, in that has lived on around, different ways of saying that. I heard someone recently saying like, oh, I want to like reclaim being barbaric, or like all these things that were kind of tossed at us. It's like, well, what's a way to kind of assert that? And
And about that story, something that I'm glad, a little thing that I'm glad I was able to correct the record about in the book is Golda, a few months after saying not nice, tried to like rehabilitate herself because like it was very clearly seen as like a condescending gaffe of a remark. Like you should not, and what she said. And then since then, the Israeli State Archive has like done a post like taking her side. And they said, oh no, she was not saying that about the Panthers. She was saying that about whoever threw Molotov cocktails. Okay. That's not true. That's simply not true. I found the actual documentation, the full context of her remarks. I was able to find that through my research. And like, she was specifically talking about the Panthers she met at the meeting who had nothing to do with any Molotov cocktails. They were all like under arrest by the time the Molotov cocktails were thrown. Like, they were not. And so she was talking about that meeting and talking about, I met them, those boys are not nice. It wasn't about, later she talked about the Molotov cocktails, but it was about, so, that's one of those things, like, that's like my hill I want to die on. And I don't know how many people care about that, but I care about it.
Yeah, correcting the record. Well, okay, so one thing that I for me, and this is an experience I had when I first moved to Oakland, the inspiration that I got from the American Black Panthers is the recognition that justice and doing justice work really actually starts with providing needs for people who have been marginalized or oppressed, right? Because you can't just come out with all this like decolonial theory and all this academic literature to communities who don't know how to read, who don't have basic food, who don't have shelter, all of these different things. And I think that there's something about the justice discourse that sometimes is like very intellectualized, as opposed to remembering that like actually a lot of movements got started by just providing needs for people so that they could show up for the meeting, and I think that there's something really interesting there of the similarities, in some ways this is I feel like a universal thing for so many movements all over the world of like being like, wait, why don't we have food? Why don't we have healthcare? Why don't we have education? Why don't we have, basic housing, like all these things? And from that, the justice politics kind of emerge. But one thing I wanted to touch on is that I'm really curious about the use of the phrase that actually shows up multiple times, by any means necessary. And obviously, in this moment now, it's a big phrase in the Palestinian community that people use, but not just, but it's about this relationship between violence and nonviolence. And I was kind of, really interested in the way that you use that around the history of the Panthers, and even in the meetings that they had, right? There were some people who are more radical, like, we need to fight for our rights by any means necessary, including violent ones. And some people were like, actually, that's too far. Like, but more so also, right, like, who is depicted as being violent, right? Is it the teenage kid who, you know, is homeless and is like throwing a rock? Or is it, right, the establishment? So I guess I'm curious to hear you speak a little bit about, yeah, this by any means necessary, and how you also kind of chose to bring that up in the book in various ways.
Yeah, I mean, just to start with the end of what you said, the police officer that was in charge of repressing the Panthers, Avram Turjiman, he was also involved. He was like a foot soldier, like a regular cop during Fadi Salimi, also there. And he, there was almost no Mizrahi struggle where his name didn't appear as being someone who was in charge of suppressing it. And he was Moroccan himself. So that's kind of sad. That speaks to the sad state of affairs. But he was known for his walkie-talkie. He would bash people's head in with his walkie-talkie. I heard that from multiple people, including himself. He talked about that. He talked to me about how he used to beat people up in Musara just to like establish his dominance. So any of these Panthers had a lifetime of getting beaten up by police and experiencing the violence that was allowed and encouraged by the state. And yes, and then they go to have their movement, and they were never anything close to the American Black Panthers in the sense that, like, they didn't have guns. American Black Panthers had an entire arsenal. Like, they were ready to go to war. I saw, you know, Elaine Brown's book. She lists like all their weapons that they had. Like, they had anti-tank missiles. They had like crazy stuff. And like the whole concept of a SWAT team, and the police have like a SWAT team that was invented in order to fight Panthers in Los Angeles. Like, and then now every police department has a SWAT team. Like, so the Israeli Panthers like had nothing like that. They talked about being radical. They talked about by any means necessary. There was a plan at one point to like kidnap and hold hostage a government minister. They didn't end up doing that because like what they wanted, they got anyway in that case. And it wasn't seen as effective. There were some like very, very radical people that were part of the Panthers, some that ended up allegedly or not helping. It was never proven, helping a Palestinian like terrorist cell in Hebron, like that was like going to use weapons to like kill civilians. There's another Panther who was arrested as part of a spy ring that was like, they're arrested as traitors because they were helping the Syrian regime, like spy on Israel. Like, that was so out of like a con out of this idea that, like, you know, they're on the side of Soviet Union and communism, and Syria was on that side, and so they're like, we're going to be good communists and we're going to help Syria. But most of the Panthers were not doing anything like that. And they spoke about by any means necessary, and they talked about how they want to destroy everything. But ultimately, that's not really what they wanted. So the American Black Panthers they looked at white America and looked at the history of how Black Americans were treated, they said, well, white America doesn't want us, and they're treating us like shit. Well, we don't want them either. We'll do a separate thing. We'll be separatists. We want to create an independent and strong and thriving Black community. Goodbye. Like, we don't necessarily need you. Israeli Panthers were not that. They wanted to belong. Like, they desperately wanted to belong.
Which is part of the tragedy of it all. I mean, and we can get to this, but like about the impacts of the Panther movement in Israeli society, which is just like, do Mizrahim ever belong, right? And that the like, is that even a possibility?
I mean, my wife did her graduate research. She did an ethnography on the Moroccan Jews who settled Dimona. And they like came to be part of like the national story and like lived on the margin, like, and had have pretty shitty jobs and like aren't don't hold a special heroic role in Israeli history books. But she found that they like reinterpreted their own story and made themselves into heroes. And they saw themselves as like pioneers, and they saw themselves like they refused to accept the narrative that was imposed on them. And they like, they crafted their own narrative and a narrative that gave them meaning, that made them able to create like beautiful community.
Yeah.
And cope with like very difficult conditions, especially in those days. Shelly Shaul is my wife's name, for the record, for anyone listening. You can read versions of her research. The whole thing hopefully will get published one day if there's some justice. But
yeah, well, I also wanted to talk about this relationship between Mizrahim and Palestinians, especially in the context of the Panthers, right? Because there's a couple interesting story there. I mean, certainly, right? The way that part of the Panthers actually was acknowledging and also fighting for a Palestinian state, which perhaps was like the one of the first times to happen
for sure.
in Israeli society. So actually, yeah, you want to share a bit of that?
Yeah, I mean, right, 1970s, almost no Israelis have support the Palestinian cause, are for a Palestinian state, acknowledge anything about the Palestinian struggle, right? It's like not like today, two-state solution. Like, no, like these are just Arabs and like whatever they want, they're just like, we're not gonna listen to these terrorists, and they don't deserve anything. You know, Matzpen was an exception, like a few dozen like randos. And you know, maybe like a professor here or there, Shayahu Leibovich, and I don't know.
Let's spend as the anti-Zionist.
Yeah, then this anti-Zionist group that tried to bring the like radical new left of the global movement to Israel, and they were a very important influence on the Panthers, but a kind of a misunderstood influence. Yeah, so the Panthers at this phase become, aside from Matzpen, like some of the very first Israelis to look at the Palestinians and say, no, what they want actually is legitimate. They, by 1975, they sign a, they approve like a position that is totally in favor of a Palestinian state. They're, in 1973 already, they start meeting with representatives of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which again, there's a terrorist organization. The Oslo Accords, right, what did Israel accept in the Oslo Accords? That the PLO are the legitimate representatives of the Palestinian people. That's the 1990s. Panthers are saying it in the 70s, in the early 70s. Charlie Biton, together with two, he became a member of Knesset, member of the parliament, and he and two other members of parliament in the Communist Party who are Palestinian, not Jewish, they go and they meet Arafat in 1980. And this is the very, very first time that an Israeli meets with Arafat. Now, there could have been, maybe there was an anonymous Israeli before, but like history doesn't know about that. He's the first like known Israeli to meet with Arafat. And the funny thing about that, about like who gets credit for being like really radical and ahead of your time, and all, Uri Avneri, the, you know, is dead, big leftist in Israeli, dead a few years ago. The last decades of his life, he devoted to like telling his story and his legacy. And he told everyone who would listen that like how he was the first to meet Arafat. And And in his obituaries and every in the BBC and in Reuters and all these places, like that was the headline. Uri Avneri, the first Israeli to meet Arafat. Well, I go into the archives and I read an article by Uri Avneri in 1980, 2 years before he met Arafat. He meets him in 82, writing, Charlie Biton meets Arafat. He's the first Israeli to meet Arafat. He's the one who like documented that fact. And then he goes and like lies about it later. It's just the people do these really funny things. And so it's again another hill I'm like I like to die on because like it's just wrong and it makes me angry. One of the Panthers, one of the things the Panthers do is they look at the growth of settlements after 67 and into the 70s and 80s and see all this like government money going to fund the settlements. And like, what are you talking about? Like, we need the money. We're like, look at how we're living. Why are you subsidizing all these people? Like, what about us? What about the slums of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Haifa? So like they have a self-interested argument for being against settlements, and they have a moral and political one of we need to make peace with our neighbors. Mizrachim, they use this analogy that we've heard a million times before and since, that Mizrachim are a bridge to the Middle East, a bridge to Arabs. We can understand them, they can understand us. Let us lead the way to peace.
Let's
Let us
talk to each
talk.
other about these, you know. Well, you know, one thing that also came up a few times, which I think is still ongoing in the current discourse around Mizrahim, is like seeing the Mizrahi struggle as like an internal issue, and then seeing like Israel-Palestine as a foreign issue or like regional issue or something disconnected. And you know, I think part of what you're saying in the book is that the Panthers were very much like, why are you not looking at domestic issues and, you know, these kind of internal issues and putting the attention there, right? You can't just like wash over this reality. But yeah, I guess I'm curious to hear you speak a little bit about that tension, right, between the internal issues versus the more regional politics. Like, are they two separate things? Are they the same thing? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean the regional issue was used and still is used to this day to like shut Mizrahim up.
Right.
They're like, oh, well, it's we're facing scary, dangerous enemies. Stop talking about your problems because like we have to focus on the enemies. Which is very convenient because the people saying that are like the people in position of privilege that like have all the resources. So
Yeah.
like, yeah, of course you want the people who are asking for resources shut up, but so that's one place where like it's just tension, and the Panthers were absolutely not having any of that. Anytime someone tried to be like, no, we're not gonna do that, and they made a lot of arguments around that. One is like that is a self-interested, like convenient thing for you to say. Two, they said that like actually, because of how we're treated, we're like a wasted resource. Like we could actually contribute to national defense or to diplomacy or to like making peace, to build to prosperity. Like, but you're not giving us education and you're not letting our voice be heard. So you're not going to be able to accomplish these like regional and international goals without us.
Right. Which is the whole purpose of even bringing me back in the first place.
And I think that's one of the lessons that I hope someone from any kind of politics can kind of really internalize about the book is that Israel's treatment of Mizrahim was a squandering of like an amazing human resource. Like there are all these people that could have given so much more to the world that weren't given a chance.
Yeah.
And that's really sad.
It's
And you don't have to
heartbreaking.
be a left winger to like care about that.
Yeah. No, it's super heartbreaking. And I think actually at the end with Reuven telling his story about being able to finally burst through the Israeli constriction, holding kind of our narratives in some ways hostage and controlling them and being able to actually, I think it's when he spoke in New York at the kind of international conference around the Black Panthers, but like being able to actually speak your truth to the world. I mean, I certainly resonate with that because I think for me, and that has informed so much of my work. Like my dream as like a child growing up in Jerusalem was to just break through the Israeli constrictions of like, why can't I speak with other Arabs? Why can't I speak with, international discourse around justice issues? Why is my narrative constantly being used and controlled by the government, by kind of the Ashkenazi establishment? Why can't I actually just speak my truth and my narrative? And I think that's something that I find that a lot of Mizrahim feel is that we rarely have the opportunity to like share our stories just in our voice, So I guess the last question I wanted to ask is, the end of the book, you talk about how, and the Panthers even acknowledged it, right? This relationship between the Panthers' activism and kind of leading creating the road for the Likud and like begging and like the whole more like right wing trajectory that we see in the Mizrahi community, especially kind of post-80s. So yeah, I wanted to just hear you describe that connection and just get your thoughts about that, this relationship between, this activism that the Panthers were doing that was rooted in kind of a universalist justice approach and was, attempting to also have solidarity with Palestinians. But right, like all of a sudden there was a different shift that happened with the majority of the Mizrahi community.
Yeah, for a lot of reasons, the Panthers did not have the wherewithal to sweep the Mizrahi public behind them and become like a major, force, for example, in parliament or anything like that. The police were actively co-opting, dividing, spying, like stoking suspicions among the group and doing all the tactics that you can think of to get rid of them. And the 1973 war happens, and then Israel is driven to like the brink, and then the public is just like in such a state of shock, and there's no one really wants to talk about the issues that Panthers raised for a while. And the Panthers just also like didn't have organizational discipline. And just like we're sloppy, we're like a lot of them used it and admitted to using like the attention they got from the Panthers to get a job, to like find a way to like not be poor, and like just needed a way out and didn't continue to press in the struggle. And but they right but so they like But that doesn't mean that their attacks on this old order, on the Mapai, didn't have an effect. It did. It kind of freed Mizrahim to rebel, to like look elsewhere. And when they started to look at what their options are, of like where else can we go, Panthers didn't seem to offer, to a lot of Mizrahim, didn't seem to offer like a viable alternative to power. But there's this other guy who did, Menachem Begin, who founded the Likud and ends up becoming prime minister in 1977. And he does something the Panthers couldn't. He offers the Mizrahim a way to belong in the national story. Now you have all these people who are like, okay, no more pretending, like we've been condescended to, we've been left out, we've been marginalized, we've been dispossessed. Like, that was real, that was wrong. We know who did it to us. He's like, here, forget all that. Forget, like, you're not just people who've been stomped upon. No, that's all completely wrong. You're brothers, you're sisters, you're warriors, you're the real Jews, you're the real Zionists. He has this like amazing, incredible speech, like this oratorical ability to tell him, come join me. Like, I'm going to put you front and center in this national story. Like, Mapai has it all wrong. he talks about how when he was in the trenches of 1948 fighting to found the country, like there were Iraqi Jews to his right and left. Like, what? How dare anyone forget that? And Mizrahim are like, wait, this is our ticket. Like, this is our ticket. This is our guy.
And as you were saying before, right, the desire for belong was so
Yeah.
deep, and also the exhaustion from,
Exhaustion,
yeah.
absolutely. Absolutely. And the Likud, they had their own like grievance against Mapai, right? Because they were revisionist Zionists. So they were left out too. Like they weren't given jobs either. They weren't given positions. They weren't given land. They were like fucked over. They were like a fringe, political group, but they had real grievances against the government too.
Yeah.
And they, like, there's this alliance of like the Mizrahim, and they're both angry about the same enemy. And of course, Mapai keeps like shooting themselves in the foot and like saying like racist things about Mizrahim and being condescending. And like, why can't like these, the whole, why can't the riffraff, like, why can't they understand anything, like that we're gonna be better for them? And like, they're too dumb for their own good. Like, they're too dumb to know what's good for them. Like, this kind of talk. And Likud's like, no, don't listen to these people. Don't listen to Mapai. We will acknowledge your rightful place in this country. And do they do that? That's a different question. How Mizrahim fare under Likud, and an Israeli right, and it's a complicated story. The leaders of Likud were and remain largely Ashkenazi. If you look even at Netanyahu's current cabinet, current government, like, yes, there's actually kind of a lot of Mizrahim in who are ministers, but like all the top ministers,
Yeah.
they're Ashkenazi. Treasury, defense, these people, maybe you want to fact check that, but who's foreign minister anyway? And there's never been a Mizrahi prime minister in Israel. And Mizrahim do see actually a lot of social mobility under Likud, because socialism didn't manage it, the Israeli socialist system didn't manage to redistribute resources in a way that benefited Mizrahim. But a lot of Mizrahim were small business owners. And so the ultra capitalism promoted by Likud like did benefit like a big, now there's a big Mizrahi middle class, and there's a lot of Mizrahi rich people too.
Right. Which a
So
lot of the struggle started also as a class struggle.
yeah. And so like capitalism was like good for Mizrahim, not all of them, and a lot of them were
Right.
left behind. And there's massive socioeconomic gaps in Israel. But like a lot of people can say genuinely and truthfully and accurately that it was good for them.
Yeah.
They were finally given, more representation in Knesset. So yeah.
So to wrap up, like with the book being published, I guess just this month, right? And we're in this current moment that we are in. Just curious to hear your thoughts of like what do you want and what do you desire and what do you hope for the book to contribute to the current discourse? And yeah, like how do you see it fitting in with, that this is the first time that it's written about in English, so.
There's a saying in the Talmud, and it came up during the time of the Panthers, "Izaru mebnei aniyim ki mehem tetzeh Torah." And like, if I do a Hebrew translation, I may want to use "Izaru mebnei aniyim" as the title. It just the translation doesn't work well in English. "Izaru mebnei aniyim ki mehem tetzeh Torah," and
Which you would translate for.
for and what that means is like, beware the children of poor folk, because from them true Torah will emerge. And that's a very rough translation. I may be missing, like I'm not a Talmudic scholar in any way, and I may be missing some nuance here, but that's like the idea. And it's a beautiful idea, and it's a reminder that the like truth and progress or ideals or whatever it is you believe in, like in can come from very unexpected places. And that for me is a reason to stay optimistic, because no one thought these, like, this collection of like street thugs was going to become the Panthers and change the country. But they did. And there are other people who are going to rise up from unexpected places and like make historic contributions that we'll only be able to understand in retrospect.
That's beautiful. I love that.
Yeah.
Is there anything we haven't touched on that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I thought you would ask this about, and maybe you should edit this back in so it's not like coming from me, but I think gender is a very very big thing that like that I was struggling with from the beginning. The people who started the Panthers were young men. Like, that's how the social group was organized. Like, and they were friends and decided to be in the Panthers. Okay. But once they start it, many women do get involved. Their girlfriends, their sisters, other just women in the community. A lot of women from the United States and Europe get involved, which is an interesting dynamic between the like these young, sexy Mizrahi men who are like, things like they were publicly very, very sexy. Like, they were handsome, they were bad boys, right? Like, they were photographed in these ways that like amplified these things about them.
Yeah, the photographs are beautiful.
Yeah. And then there's all these like, right, and the Mizrahi women, the young Mizrahi women weren't like available to them because they were like relegated to more traditional roles in the home. So they have but then they have all these like young American and European women coming to visit, and there's like this mutual attraction and like these love affairs and marriages today.
That's gonna be a whole book.
Yeah, like really interesting, juicy stuff. And so the women get involved, but also women get involved in the protests. They get and they get involved. You know, you asked this question about providing needs of people. So this is a lot of work that was not documented, is invisibilized. Like, the meals that were cooked, the prison support, right? All these Panthers are in prison all the time, people bringing them cigarettes and meals. You know, apparently you could bring home like warm cooked food to people in prison at the time, and they did that. Sadia Moxano's mom was like a huge force, like, that kept them fed and kept them going. Mazal Sa'il was this activist who was like an absolute force, just fought with the police. I have a picture of her, like, no one else has seen a picture of this woman before. I mean, she appeared in a documentary, but like, I found this photo of like her, like, I heard about her. I heard about her so much. And she's mostly known as the wife of like the guy who like disappeared. Dani Sayle like disappeared in Europe. And there's this like conspiracy theorist that the Mossad assassinated him with. And she tries to find what happens to him later on. But she was like her own fighter in the days of the Panthers. And, so I have this photo of her. And there are other women. I tried to find a lot of them. There was Shulmit Sabari, a Yemenite, like a 19-year-old woman, Yemenite woman at the time. Couldn't find her. There are a lot who died. And the press didn't interview them, so I don't have that. The police cared more about these like few male leaders. The Panthers themselves, when they kept records or when they shared stories, they tended to tell their own stories of like them and other men. So like in terms of the oral history and like the passing down of folk tales, like less of that for women. So we don't have much information.
Yeah.
And I'd love to, like, you know, there could be more attempts. There's new additional directions that maybe people can find. I think other disciplines could really help, like the discipline of oral history, and could help excavate like more of these stories. So I'd like there to be more work done around that.
You know, what's interesting about that is that, you know, in the current moment of like Mizrahi activism, certainly on the ground, it's largely led by women, actually. And it's actually very rare to find Mizrahi men who are coming to the protests, coming to the meetings, contributing. Like, so it's just also interesting seeing that gendered dynamic, you know? I mean, even with Reuven, right? A lot of the younger activists who come tend to be women, you know? So interesting, because, and also about, you know, what you're talking about in terms of like the love affairs and all that stuff, that certainly is a huge thing in the Mizrahi community around, right? Mizrahi not dating other Mizrahim, whether it's men, women, women, men, women, whatever, queer relationships, but like, right, that whole kind of intermarriage is so much of how Mizrahim also lost the struggle in some ways. It's just, right, assimilating or becoming Ashkenazi or whatever it is, like not kind of preserving that more, I guess, tribal identity, or finding resistance, right? Which is, I don't think unique to Mizrahim. I think that's common in a lot of racialized groups. So yeah, I mean, there's definitely a whole, that's a whole other book of just doing Mizrahim and gender in the modern times, but.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very true. I don't, be interesting to try and explain why things are like that right now. I don't have any hot takes.
Well, I mean, I think when you like date someone of your own identity, you really have to also confront your that identity. And I think the state that a lot of Mizrahim are in right now, they don't necessarily want to talk about the past or how they got to where they are, or, you know, it's a bit too much excavating all of it. I mean, certain people.
There's the relationship thing, but there's also like the why are so many of the organizers and women?
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, those both those issues I'd like to understand.
Yeah, do you have answers about that?
No, no, I don't. I don't. For the record, maybe this shouldn't. I don't know how I'll come off by even saying this, but like I married a Mizrahi woman, so for the record.
Totally. Thank you for clearing the record. It is possible.
Yeah.
Sustain the community. Yeah, no, for sure. But I mean, these dynamics are still very much alive, you know, and evolving. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Asaf. Is there
thank
any
you.
Last things you want
no,
to
this
share?
Is this is the best. Like talking to someone who actually knows this stuff and like asking smart questions is like a pleasure, and I have a feeling this is going to be, if not the very best, one of the very best like interviews I'm had and I'm going to have and going to have about the book. So thank you so much.
Yeah, of course, it's my pleasure, and it was so lovely to have you, and thank you for all the decades of research you've done in providing this scholarship. And if folks want to buy the book, it's available everywhere. No,
yeah, like Amazon, if that's not your thing, like bookshop.org or anywhere you get books.
Okay,
yeah.
Beautiful.